listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got a really great show for you on building your own authentication. So diving deep into JWT and sessions and tokens and cookies and local storage and CSRF and all that stuff. We're going to attempt to explain how it all works. With me, as always, is Mr. Scott Tolinsky. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing okay. It's a needling done in my back this morning. That feels pretty good. So I'm just trying to wake up here. I was telling Wes before we recorded, we had like a four course like wine pairing with our Valentine's Day meal that we had ordered. We had done carry out from one of these fancy places and they let you bring it all home, including the wine pairings.
Yeah.
So I'm officially dragging. I think it's safe to say definitely dragging today.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be careful with that once you're over 30. You can't casually have three glasses of wine on a Sunday night.
No, thank you. Yeah, it was a decision that we made. It was like after the second course, we were like, should we continue with this? I guess so. And the kids got to bed somehow and we just passed out.
Oh, man. We have three awesome sponsors today: Prismic Headless CMS, second one LogRocket JavaScript Session Replay, and third one Hasura, which is the instant GraphQL API for your data. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode, but let's get on into it. So you recently redid the auth for your platform, right?
Yeah. A little bit of history of the auth for our setup was that we had originally just used Meteor, which has baked in auth, right? And that's all baked into the platform. So it's something I've never had to worry about. Even in the initial phase of things, even the UI was based in the platform. It was all just a drop-in, right? So for me, it's been largely one of those things I've been able to ignore for the most part. Now, at some point, we were like, okay, we need to get off Meteor because we're only using a couple of things from it, the build tool and the auth system, right? Build tool is a little bit easier for me to wrap my head around. What do I need to do? The auth system, I was like, okay, first, let's go ahead and try to replace it with another package. So we found Accounts.js, which is made by some folks who used Meteor in the past. So it was very compatible. It's GraphQL based. I had to do less work, apparently, to connect our current account system. Like, the last thing I want is all of the users to have to resubmit their authentication or something like that, you know, like log everybody out and whatever. So I was trying to do this as like low friction as possible. And we wrote Accounts.js for a little bit, but we kept on hitting kind of little weird issues here and there. And what happens with systems, especially ones baked in accounts, when you try to do a lot, and in Accounts.js, it's trying to do a lot, right? You can use any database with it. You can use any API layer, or REST or GraphQL. You can use Mongoose or MongoDB, like whatever. They're trying to do so many things. And because of that, the exact qualifications of the things that I need are very like 10% of what that package does. So at some point we looked into it and we're like, would it be worth it for us to just roll our own 100% from scratch? That way we would have full control over the verification process, the full control over user accounts in general, and stop relying on any sort of package. And I went for it. And I just said, you know what? I'm going to learn everything there is to learn about this stuff and do it the best I can and just start hacking away on it. Next thing you know, I got ourselves an account system that's fully customized and is completely feature compatible with what we had. Now, is that the smartest thing moving forward? Maybe. We're going to find out. But we wrote our own account system and it wasn't so bad. So now my head is ultra in this space.
Awesome. Yeah, I've done my fair share of login systems over the years, my own personal course platform, couple different tutorials. The last time I recorded Advanced React, we did it all ourselves. And then the time that I re-recorded, I used the built-in one in Keystone just because it's there. And it's definitely tricky, especially like if you're not all that interested in going down the rabbit hole, and like you really have to learn a lot because you could screw it up. And that could be a huge security hole in your application. So you need to make sure that you know what you're doing. But I feel like I've done it enough now that I know the ins and outs of all of it. And today we're going to be primarily focusing on one type, which is like JSON web tokens, which is, I would say, probably the most popular way to do auth these days.
Yeah. And so for a bit of a heads up, JSON web tokens, JWT, as you often see it, JSON web tokens, let's give a little bit of a background on what these things are. I think one of the biggest misconceptions for people who don't know what they are might think that it is encrypted data, but it's not encrypted. It's encoded. It's just base 64 encoded. So like, if you've ever worked with images where you've encoded an image into a string of data, that is just a string of data that's readable by the computer and it outputs some information. So JWTs are not necessarily secure. You're not going to want to put something secure inside of a JWT that the client can access, so to say. But obviously, working with authentication, we want to be putting in information that can log the session in. So JWT is a base 64 encoded but not encrypted token that contains JSON data, essentially.
The way that it works is that when somebody signs into your application on the server side, you take their username and their password, or you take their whatever method they're using to sign in. We'll use username and password as the most common way to do it. You take that and you make sure that the username and the password are correct. And if they are, and we'll talk about matching if they're correct in just a second, but if they are, then you generate what's called a JWT JSON web token. And this token has three parts to it. It has a header, it has a payload, and has a signature. So the header is just a little piece of information about what type of algorithm was used to generate this JSON web token. So there's all kinds of different ones. I don't understand what they are. I just sort of picked the most popular one and go with that. The payload is probably the more important part. So the payload will include JSON. It includes JSON in your web token, and that can be used to hold information about the user. So most popular is going to be the user's name, their email address, like a refresh token. We'll talk about what that is in just a second. But sometimes if you want to hold a little bit of information about the user, usually 3 or 4 or 5 different pieces of key value stores, you can stick that in the JSON web token payload. And the reason why that's so handy is because when somebody makes a request, so let's say somebody requests / courses, what you can do is you can quickly look up the user's, you can take their ID and then quickly look up courses where that user's ID is equal to it. So previously with session base, you have to look up the user in the database every single time there is a request. And that still is a pretty popular thing if you need to do permissions and whatnot. But sometimes if you just need to know the user's name or their ID or any of this information, it's not necessary to go to the database and look the user up because that data comes along in the payload. Now you might be saying, okay, Wes, isn't that like a security issue if the user's like email address is in the token? Like, couldn't the user just take that out of the token, change the email address, and put it back in the token? And that's where the third part comes in, which is it's a signature. The signature is the bit where you take the header and the payload and you run those through the actual algorithm. And if somebody changes their user ID or email or anything in that, then that signature is not going to be valid against the data that it's being sent. And your backend will say, something broke here because you tried it. And like, I was doing this myself on Friday. I was implementing auth in one of my apps. And I was like, okay, I had the most basic auth, which is just check if the user's email address is my email address. And I was like, well, could somebody just like change their email address in the JSON web token? And I tried it. And the answer is no, because then the data does not match up with the signature that we have there. So those are the three parts of JSON web tokens.
Yeah. And so how we ended up doing it is we did a session-based flow of things where the session is tracked in the server. And we have two JSON web tokens that get set. And they get set in cookies. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But we set an access token and a refresh token. And so the access token contains only the session ID and the user ID. And it expires whenever the user closes that browser window. Then there's also the refresh token, which basically just includes the session ID. And that session ID can look up whether this is an active session and check to make sure that the user is correct. So that way it can generate a new access token and send the user a new access token. This is also something that works if you're like opening up in a new browser window, although I think session cookies actually stay when you open up a new browser window. So I guess it's just if the browser window is closed, then that session cookie, the access token, JWT, is then reset.
So what's the benefit of doing that sort of like two-step process over just giving someone an access token and accepting it for forever or however long you need it?
Yeah, it prevents like stale access. So the refresh token will not authenticate a session without checking in to the database, without checking in to make sure that it's an active session, where the access token itself does not check for an active session. It just grabs the user information. Do they have an access token? Then the current session is valid. Therefore, we don't have to do the whole rigmarole of checking to see if their session is active. This allows us to be able to, you know, withdraw sessions from people, those types of things. And it also has an expiry of like 90 minutes. So that way, if it is 90 minutes past, that token will become expired, the access token, it will need to use the refresh token. But if we then cancel that session, they'll have to log in again themselves. So what it does is it gives us as administrators much more control over who's logged in, when and where and how via active sessions.
Yeah. If you want to log somebody out, you can do that, right? Like that sometimes it happens. There's someone will say, hey, I logged into this computer at school and I forgot to log out and now I'm gone. How do I sign out of other things? And that's what you can do with those tokens.
That's also how you would give the user that interface as well. You know, sometimes you see in your apps, they'll say, you currently have, you know, 5 active sessions. Would you like to remove any of these active sessions or whatever? You know, you've ever seen that interface. So that's typically how they would do that. Again, that's a database table of sessions itself. So we have a full-on table that is just sessions.
Beautiful. Yeah, I do the exact same thing with my course platform as well. So if you want to be able to log somebody out, you just got to nuke their specific session or all of the sessions associated with that account, and then they will no longer be able to be logged into the course.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into the flow. So that's a JWT, right? That's where the access and refresh token or perhaps user information is stored. Maybe we should take a step back here and say, all right, registration. When the user submits their username and password to your site on registration, here's what happens. Okay, so the username and password are typically sent in plain text over to the server. Now, you might be wondering, like, is that a security issue? Well, that's why we have SSL certificates. An SSL certificate is going to encrypt that information on the way from the server or from the client to the server so that plain text username and password are not found. Now, some people still prefer to encrypt the password before sending it along, but it's not really required. It doesn't even make sense to me as to why you would do that, except for maybe server logs or something like that, if you were logging people's passwords for any particular reason, which you shouldn't be doing.
If you're encoding it on the client, then the key that you're using to encode it would be accessible to the person, right?
Yeah. It doesn't make sense.
I got an email like this one day. Like I'll get these emails from people who've been like, I found a major security issue in your platform. And then I'm like, oh my gosh. And I immediately jump on a call with them. And then they're like, you're sending your passwords in plain text. I'm like, all right. And then I have to have like this like 10-minute, I don't fault the person for not understanding how it works, but it's kind of like my blood's pumping and everything like that. Yeah. And it's kind of scary, right? So like, let's just make that very clear. When you log into a service, you send your password as plain text. Even though there's dots in the input, it's just plain text being sent over to your server. And the reason why that's okay is because the connection between your browser and the server is encrypted, meaning that the NSA, somebody else on your same Wi-Fi, the US government, those people cannot sniff the wire along the way. Well, they can, but they can't unencrypt the data that's going along the wire at that time. There's some debate as to whether that's true or not, but that's the way SSL works.
And before we even go any further, because the next part's going to include two more dictionary words here, I think maybe a good explainer between encryption, hashing, and salting. And so if you've heard those three words before, you might have conflated them in some sort of way or maybe known that they're different. But here's the difference. Okay. Encryption is the use of a key like a secret, to obfuscate and retrieve data. You have some data, it encrypts it with a key, it cannot be cracked without that key. However, since you can get the information, encrypt it, and get it back, that's what makes it encryption. Okay? Hashing is the same type of deal, but it's a one-way trip. You cannot unencrypt a hash. A hash is obfuscated data that will permanently remain obfuscated. So you could think of it as a one-way encryption. So that's hashing. The most popular hashing algorithm is probably SHA-256, which is what we use. SHA stands for Security Hashing Algorithm. So you've probably seen SHA-256, MD4, MD5, the type of thing around. SHA-256 is probably the most common one at this point. Now, there's also salting, which you've probably heard. Salt and hash your passwords. Do not store plain text passwords. So what salting does is it adds a predetermined amount of text to the end of your data. So if you had a password, and let's say the password is password, and your salt, let's say the salt is salt, the new password would be password salt, all one word. Then you would hash that first. Now, the thing is that the server needs to know what the salt and the hashing algorithm and all of that is so that it can properly compare them later. So that is the difference between salting, hashing, and encrypting. So what happens when we send our plain text passwords to the server, you're creating a user. Typically what you do is you salt the user password, then you hash it, then you store it in the database. You do not store a plain text password in the database ever. Because if your database is compromised, then those plain text passwords are going to be for the picking, and then anybody can potentially get access to that information. Now, remember what we said about hashing. Hashing is a one-way trip. So unless the hacker has an extremely powerful computer, they know your salt, they know your key, any of that stuff, it is going to be extremely impossible for them to unencrypt that hash. It just is not going to work. So that's why we salt and hash.
Yeah, the way that unencrypting or unhashing passwords works is not that they're just like running this algorithm. They're just running random passwords through the hashing algorithm and seeing if they match it. So if sometimes you hear, probably the most common one is when a WordPress database gets leaked. WordPress, I don't believe it uses salting. It just uses MD5 straight away. And if your password is dogs, and you run it through MD5, the output of, here, let me do it for you right now. The output of dogs from MD5 is D28, D2D, and blah, blah, blah. It's like this really long string, right? And then if someone were to find in a database this D28, D3 hash, then they will know, okay, well, that's a very common word. Someone's already hashed that. And there are massive databases online of already hashed words. Like people have been running computers day in, day out for 20 years to make these huge databases. So that's why it's important to salt your passwords, because as soon as you add some random piece of salt to your hash, then these predetermined MD5 hashes are no longer good to them. And they would have to know your salt. And then second, they would have to start generating their own database of hashes. And that's significantly harder for somebody to do. So that's a good thing for you, the application developer, always salt it. And then it's also good for just like people who are setting passwords, is don't use common dictionary words, because they're going to be, they will be guessed.
Yeah, they'll frequently be hearing this is something called brute forcing, which is just the sheer amount of computer force being just thrown at this thing, trying to try every possible combination. But if they don't know the salt, that's not going to work, because again, the hashing is a one-way street. And before we get into the next section, let's go ahead and talk about one of our sponsors today. That is Prismic.
Yes, Prismic is headless CMS. The way that it works is you sign up, you create your data types, you create relationships, and they just generate an interface for you. You don't have to, it's all hosted for you. You don't have to code anything yourself. The whole UI is just created for you. There's a REST API, there's a GraphQL API, you can pull it in. One thing I'm going to talk about today is a couple of their features. They have scheduling and previews for their data. So if you want to be able to modify some data and then preview it in your app. You can do that. Or if you want to modify some data and say, all right, I want this to go live, like the price of an item. I want it to go on sale Monday at 9 a.m. You can go ahead and schedule that. And that's really, really cool because this is not just a very basic bare bones CMS. There's a lot of UI that your end users are going to love to use. So check it out, prismic.io/syntax. Thanks so much to Prismic for sponsoring. All right, let's talk about the next piece.
So the user has signed up for your site. And by signing up, what they've done is they've created a unique salted hash stored in your database that is one-way encrypted, aka hashed, not encrypted. I keep saying one-way encrypted, but encrypted by definition, I believe, means that it's two-way. Sorry about that. Don't want to get flamed about that. So the data is stored in the database, and how do we log somebody in? Because the registration process and the authentication process are two different things. And I think often we conflate these as being the same deal. Well, how we chose to do the authentication piece, it would be to automatically log the user in after registering, because that kind of makes sense, right? But for us to log a user in, what we did is we stored the access token and the refresh token, which again are JWTs, we stored those as HTTP only cookies, and those are set server side. Now, JWTs could be stored anywhere, and primarily you'll see them stored in cookies or local storage. Now, some people misunderstand this cookie storage as being the same type of cookie that you can store and set from anywhere. And some people do that, but the thing to know about normal cookies and local storage is that they are both accessible by anything on the client, browser extensions, you name it, right? If it's on the client, it has access to it, except for HTTP only cookies, which can only be set or accessed server side, which is kind of an interesting thing that we have largely forgotten about now that we've been doing so many things client side, right? So for us, the cookie is set via the response payload on the server, and it is only accessed on the server. So the client doesn't really do anything except for store it. Now, we also use the secure flag for HTTP only cookies, which is only accessible if you're running on an SSL certificate, same domain sort of stuff. So
that's important. We should point out why that's important is because if you're using HTTP, not HTTPS, with your cookie, then your cookie value is going over the network. And I remember when I was in high school there, I've talked about this before there, or not in high school, in university, there was this Firefox extension called FireSheep. And like you could just run it and sit in like a coffee shop and people's Facebook and whatever would just start popping up and you just click the button and it logged you right in. So I'm told that's how it worked. It's unreal that like you should never ever send a cookie value over HTTP. And unfortunately, that's pretty common with WordPress right now, just because most people install a WordPress and they don't have an SSL certificate for it. And then you're sending that cookie over the wire, and that could be very easily picked up, whether it's on public Wi-Fi or anyone along your ISP, anyone along the line can grab it. Mm-hmm.
That is a very important piece, I think. I remember listening to some podcasts when I first found out about like the what people do for like packet sniffing and stuff, where they'll jump on various networks on airport Wi-Fi and just harvest data. I'd be just being truly horrified. So that's always something to keep in mind. There's this tweet thread that went around the a couple months ago, and this guy's like, you do never need to use cookies for anything. Can we all just agree to not use cookies anymore? It's like, no, you're wrong. Cookies, HTTP only, secure cookies are the way to do authentication in my mind. And the only way I saw that was more secure than that was Hasura saying to store it in RAM. So like, Hasura had a blog post about how to store it in RAM, and it was so complex. I was like, oh man, I don't know about this. So I checked... I checked some other sites like Reddit and saw how they were doing it. HTTP only cookies, okay, people? Now, one thing to know about these is that you might be thinking, oh, yeah, I'm using cookies. Do I need to toss up one of those ugly GDPR banners now? No, actually, I found out that GDPR cookies do not apply to any required cookies, things like authentication. So as long as it's not tracking people or whatever, it's just used for authentication, your access tokens, you don't need to tell them that you're storing those
cookies
subject to GDPR. Yeah, I just confirmed that too, because I remember hearing that, and then I wanted to confirm it before we record the show. And let me even see if I can find out the exact wording on there, because GDPR is something that is interesting, but I can't necessarily say I'm an expert on it. Okay, so the European Commission describes strictly necessary cookies as user input cookies for the duration of a session, authentication cookies for the duration of a session, which is what we're doing, and then user-centric security cookies, multimedia content player session cookies, load balancing session cookies, and user interface customization cookies that are set for a few hours. Those are all GDPR compliant, okay? So you don't have to worry about it.
It's mostly just the tracking cookies that you have to warn about. Like, I don't even know GitHub just went all out and said, all right, well, we're just not going to have any of that on our website.
Yeah, we don't have any of that.
They were able to get around having to do that. So the other way to where do you put your JWT, you put that in, you can put it in local storage. So we should say, like, we're talking about the web browser here, but like if you're building like an iOS app in Swift, you can still use JWT. You just have to like store that token somewhere, because as far as I know, iOS doesn't have a concept of cookies. That's unique to an actual browser. So you can also store them in the client. A lot of people will store them in local storage. And when you do it in local storage, you are now having to handle it all client side. So when the JWT comes back from your server, you signed in successfully, it's up to you to put that thing in the local storage. And then every single time that you make a request, it's up to you to pull that thing out of local storage and attach it to your fetch request or whatever you're using to actually send the request. And this was like really popular a couple of years ago. And I sort of feel like the tides are turning back to cookies, thankfully, just because I just found it to be a pain in the butt to have to pull the cookie out every single time, or you had to write some middleware that would automatically do that for you. And then also the initial request, when somebody types in a page and goes to it, you never get the authenticated version of that page, because local storage JWTs don't go along on that initial ride like a cookie would. Because let's say you're going to westboss.com. You type in westboss.com and you hit enter. What's happening there is that you're making a request to the server, and any cookies that are in your browser because you visited that website before, they're automatically sent along for the ride. Whereas local storage cookies are not. They don't come along unless you make a JavaScript request and send it along. So that's a bit of a pain if you want to do like server-side rendered authenticated states. And that's also sometimes when you visit a website and then like a second later, you see the login button change from login to your avatar. That's because they had to load the page and then make a request to, is this user signed in? Then it had to come back. And then they said, oh, it is. They are signed in. And then they had to update their UI. So I'm like, there's some security blog posts of cookies being more secure. I don't totally understand either of them, but just from like an ergonomic standpoint, I much prefer the cookies approach.
I think the only reason that cookies are more secure for this are when you're using HTTP only cookies, because they cannot be accessed by the client whatsoever. And so that's the only reason why they could be more secure. Because if you do have a browser extension, that browser extension can pluck your JSON web token out of local storage if it wants. So that's something. But again, I don't know how real any of these threats actually are in practice.
Yeah, it could. Like, you got to stay like suspicious, I think, when you got to stay suspicious. So if you go to like a logged in website, type in document.cookie into your console, and you'll see that those are not all the cookies that are available to you, because some cookies are not available via JavaScript. And that stops malicious actors like a browser extension from reading that value. There still is another thing called CSRF. We'll talk about that in a bit, but
I actually think HTTP only cookies blocks CSRF. So that might be the thing. And if you're sending like a cookie along local storage, you would have to use the authorization header. Is that correct? Because I haven't personally used the authorization header. So since we're doing ours via cookie,
you can send them along any way that you want. Your server side has to be able to pull it out of it. So a lot of people will send them over authorization header, like a bearer token as an auth header is another one. But you could literally send it along as like a query string if you wanted. But that's what auth headers are for, though. So yeah, most people do that.
Okay, interesting. I mean, since I've been writing my own, I've only used the HTTP only cookie for it. And it has been largely easy because it's just available to you on the server no matter when you need it. And any user, like anything that we're calling is always being called from the server for us. So, I mean, that seems like a big pro. Another small thing before we move on to the next section would be that HTTP only cookies, they have very strict rules. And so because of that, I have found they are exceedingly PIA to get set up in specifically some browsers, Safari being the one that has the biggest restrictions. And so for us, we had to move our domain off of localhost to get the HTTP only cookie authentication to work locally. So we had to do a reverse proxy for our server so that it could be one HTTPS locally, which is a big thing, right? I don't know if you've ever had any issues personally, Wes, where you move your site to HTTPS and all of a sudden things don't work. Well, we've always ran our local host in just HTTP and then moved it up to the server, HTTPS, and maybe you missed a URL here or there that needed that HTTPS in front of it or something. So now we actually run our local environment all HTTPS now. We're using Caddy, which is a Go-based server for this. We use Caddy as a reverse proxy, and it's like a two-liner of configuration. And then we get HTTPS leveluptutorials.dev and then API.leveluptutorials.dev on the local host using updated our host file, whatever, so that those requests can pass through. And I got to say, Caddy, if you're interested in running an HTTPS on your local host or a reverse proxy where you're using a real domain for developing locally, Caddy, in my mind, is the way to go, because just about everything else I looked into in terms of setting up some sort of a process to generate SSL certificates for localhost just had me being very upset at life. I mean, I just really did not like it. And then we popped in Caddy in a couple lines of configuration, and then we ran Caddy run, and it automatically generated SSL certificates first try, had everything working and just perfect. So Matt Holt, who created Caddy, he had tweeted at us when we were asking about, like, what do people use for this kind of thing? He was tweeting, why don't you use Caddy server? And at first, I forget if it was you or me, but somebody was like, I don't want to spend, minutes learning some config. And he was like, try seconds. And I was like, oh, okay. Let me try it. And it was literally seconds.
No, I had used it a couple times. I went back in the syntax show notes and I had mentioned it like 2 years ago, but I've never actually used it on a full-blown project. I'd always done Nginx configs. And I was amazed at how quickly I could get HTTPS running. And it wasn't the like crappy, like it is HTTPS, but you got to click allow or continue anyways on your browser. Like it just like worked. And I was like, that's the first time I've ever seen HTTPS on localhost just work.
Yeah.
Without a whole bunch of like BS to go along with it.
Yeah, totally. If any of this stuff scares you, well, maybe you want to have some sort of error and exception handling service to track when users are failing their login sessions. And then one of those services that gives you a nice visual into the user's flow of things is LogRocket. And I'm talking about logrocket.com/syntax. This is one of those services that really needs to be seen to believe. If you've ever had an issue where a client has a bug on your site and you cannot reproduce it, well, no longer, because what this does is it takes a session replay, which is a video scrubbable video replay where you get access to the dev tools and stuff. You get access to the network tab. You get access to the Redux store, any of that cool stuff, the error console log, to see exactly what happened at the scene of the crime. So check it out, logrocket.com/syntax. Sign up right the second. You'll get 14 days for free. Okay, so I thought we would dive a little bit more into sessions. So sessions, as we stated, are a way to greater control who's logged in and from what computer. If you've ever logged in from a website and then maybe you went on your phone and also logged in on your phone and then you went to the library and then logged in, those are three different sessions. And those sessions are active until the user clicks the logout button. And so again, this is taken care of by access and refresh tokens. And a refresh token, as you'll often see, is not capable of authenticating the user on its own. But what it's capable of doing is looking up an active session. This means that for this cookie to be used, it must be run on the server in the database. Again, it's only like where our access token is a session-based cookie. That cookie is removed at the end of the session. This one can stay a little bit longer, maybe like a couple days. However, the caveat there, you might be saying, well, how do people stay logged in if they close their browser for more than a couple of days? Well, each time you generate an access token, I actually generate a new refresh token, which means that it's, you know, 30 days or whatever from the last time that they accessed the site, not from when they first logged in. So a refresh token is stored for us in the cookie. It's a JWT. It's sent over to the server. It's decoded. It is then used to look up the session because the session ID is stored within that token. The session ID is then pulled up in the database and says, is this session active? If it's active, then it can generate a new access token, send that along to the user, and it's now authenticated the user. So for somebody to spoof that with, if one, they would have to steal your refresh token somehow, which is only stored via a secure HTTP only cookie. Okay, let's say they steal that refresh token. They somehow get it set into their browser, which they can't do anyways. They could send that along theoretically, and the session would still have to be an active session for the authentication process to work. So there's a lot at play here, and that's often why you'll see refresh tokens being used. It's for this whole session-based flow of things.
Awesome. On Chrome DevTools, you can set HTTP-only cookies, but like you said, someone would have to first get a hold of that token at some way, and if they did, then you are in trouble anyways.
You can set HTTP-only from, let's say,
Yeah, you can do it via the Chrome DevTools. You can't do it via JavaScript.
I'm in Chrome DevTools here. I'm on TweetDeck.
Application.
I'm going to store an HTTP-only cookie for TweetDeck here. Yeah, mine's not letting me do it.
Oh, really?
Like, I can store a cookie, but I can't make it HTTP-only and secure. I don't know why.
I was able to edit mine on Friday via the tools, but that doesn't really matter because that's a debugging tool. And if somebody has your token, then yeah, you're screwed.
You're screwed to a point, right? Yeah. But that in itself is very difficult, right?
Yeah.
So these are definitely some of the things that we're dealing with here. When you're working with security, it's important to know that your user's information is sacred and that you need to protect it at all costs. So if there's anything really super secure, like a plain text password, that should always be hashed, right? And likewise, you shouldn't be storing information that could be seen as potentially dangerous or harmful on the client where it's accessible via extensions or something like that, right? Let's talk about Coors.
My favorite beer.
So Coors, well, I know it's probably not, but side note, we went to the Coors Brewery Tour in Golden, Colorado. I think I mentioned this before in the show.
Oh.
It is so cool. You know what? It is a giant, giant facility. I'm not a Coors beer fan, but we've done the tour like three or four times because it's such a cool facility. They have their own mountain water source, literally in the Rocky Mountains. It's a very, very cool tour if you're ever in Golden, Colorado. So Coors stands for Cross-Origin Resource Sharing. Do you want to dive into Coors, Wes? I know you are a man of Coors.
Yeah. So if you want to make a request from one domain name to another domain name, you have to enable Coors on your server-side application. So if Scott, or like leveluptutorials.com, if I wanted to pull in an API of Scott's courses and display them on my website, Scott might have an API endpoint that's like /API/courses, and I would request them from westboss.com. By default, that doesn't work because by default, you cannot request or push data from one website domain to another website domain because that's a security issue. I shouldn't be able to request a list of your bank accounts from westboss.com because you're logged in on another tab. But sometimes you do want to be able to share things across multiple domain names. So if you've got like just two different domain names that are the same application, or if you have an API that needs to be consumed by other domain names, you can either pass a list of allowed domain names as part of your response. Or like Scott could say, all right, this list of courses can be displayed on westboss.com, syntax.fm, scottdolinsky.com, and level up tutorials, right? Those are the only four domain names that are allowed to request data. Otherwise, not allowed. We should say that that is only true in the browser. You can do these things server side without, the course is not a thing on the server side. That's a bit of a pain in the butt because when you are doing authentication cross domain name, it can get really tricky. You usually have to visit the actual website in order for a cookie to be set. So all the browsers are, especially Safari, are really cracking down on being able to set cookies via things like tracking pixels and whatnot, because you used to be able to do like image source equals leveluptutorials.com/pixel.png. And then what would happen is that you visit my website, but because I put a pixel from Scott's website in mine, Scott's website now knows that you visited my website because it says it's able to set a cookie, but it's also able to look at the referring request. So that is still kind of a thing, but it is much more complicated now because the browsers are cracking down, thankfully, on a lot of these trackers and spy and ads and all that. So the downside of that is it makes auth a little bit tougher. And generally, the thing is that you actually need to be able to visit the website. You can't iframe it in. You can't just set a cookie. You can't just set an image, something like that. You have to actually visit the website to set the cookie and then come back. And usually it's not a huge issue because you are either on the same domain name or you're on the same subdomain name, at least like auth.whatever.com.
Yeah, that's largely how ours has worked with subdomains. You know, course is frustrating for a lot of people because you do have to set it on the server. And so some people, especially if they're working with an external API, might hit that and be like, oh, what do I do now? Well, you need to get your domain on one of the approved domains somehow, whether or not you have control over that server, right? So next little bit, maybe we should take a break to talk about one of our sponsors, which is Hasura, which actually makes auth fairly easy with their platform. So I'm so glad that Hasura is sponsoring Syntax because this is a service I've used for a little bit myself, and especially for some fun projects when you just want to get up and running with a GraphQL API. But if you're not, it's not one of those prototyping services. This is the real deal where you can get up and running insanely fast with a GraphQL API and a Postgres database. And for the most part, you don't even have to think too much about the entire code of things. You don't need to handwrite your server endpoints or anything like that. Hasura is really, really pretty smart and really gives you the tools to build something very advanced very quickly. It even has a granular authorization baked in with complex rules down to the individual row and column level. And this thing is very, very configurable. With Hasura, users typically save more than half the time they would take to build a GraphQL server, according to Hasura. And that's like very, very evident when you start to use it, especially if you've hand-rolled your own GraphQL server in the past. There's also Hasura Cloud, which is a managed service, and it gives you things like auto-scaling, right? Nobody wants to deal with scaling. I don't want to deal with that. And if you sign up for the free tier, it only takes a moment and you have an instant GraphQL and REST server. So head on over to hasura.info/free trial and use the coupon code TRYHASURA, TRYHASURA. And you're going to get 3 months of Hasura Cloud for free. And this is one of these offers you're going to have to act fast on. Only the first 100 listeners get this kind of crazy deal. So head on over to Hasura, hasura.info/free trial. Use the coupon code TRYHASURA, HASURA, and get 3 months of Hasura Cloud for free. Very, very cool. So thank you so much for Hasura for sponsoring. So we're using Fastify. To set cores, we used a Fastify plugin for cores. But if somebody is running like an Express server or something like that, what do they do when they need to turn to cores, right?
There's a package called on NPM called cores, and it actually works on Next.js, it works on Express. I think it's based on the Kinect middleware, so it just works with most platforms out there. You pass it cores, and then you pass it your settings. So you allow either star, or you can allow it an array of websites, or you can give it a function where it will regex match it based on what you want. And then the only other thing is that you explicitly, like if you're making a fetch request in your JavaScript on the client, you some or often need to explicitly set the include credentials.
Oh yeah, include credentials. Man, I feel like there's so many little things that you hit over the course of this stuff, like yeah. include credentials, CORS errors, obviously, but these little things, even like getting the origin and domain correct for our HTTP only cookies was like, is a challenge. Every little bit was a challenge.
Yeah. So the fetch, when you make a fetch request on the client, there is a credentials property that you set in the options. You can set that to include or same origin or omit, and that will decide whether or not it should send along your cookies for the ride every single time that you make a request. And by default, if you're going cross origin, they will not. I think the default is same origin, meaning that if you're requesting from one domain name to another domain name, it's not going to send the cookies along unless you explicitly say include. Next one we have here is CSRF, which is cross-site request forgery. And often when you sign into something, you will also generate a CSRF token. And what that is, what CSRF is when a website like westboss.com assumes that you're logged in to another website like leveluptutorials.com. And like, let's say Scott has like an endpoint that says delete account. If I were to ping that delete account endpoint from my website to Scott's website, somebody visits my website and I run a fetch request that pings the delete account endpoint on Scott's website. But because the users are logged into Scott's website, then it will still send the cookies along for the ride, right? And that is a potential issue because you're making a request that's valid. And because the cookies always come along for the ride, then that's a potential issue. So often a server will make every single request you get a CSRF token. And then that token, when you make another request, has to be sent along with it. Otherwise, you could be running into some issues there. I think you said earlier that is not an issue with if you're doing HTTPS. I don't think that's true because that's not an XSS attack. It's different than like someone being able to access the JavaScript tokens. This is just like if I request from anywhere on the web, those cookies could come along for the ride because HTTP only cookies are still sent along on every single request. So the fact if you make them HTTP only or not doesn't have anything to do with if that cookie is sent to the server. So if there is a potential that somebody is making a request from another website, then you need to think about that and maybe implement CSRF tokens.
There's also the same site cookie property.
Oh, yeah. That's something that's a little beyond. Like the stuff goes deep, right?
Yeah.
And at a lot of times you can get away with just knowing enough and digging in as much as Scott and I have done, but you can also get really, really deep. And there also, but beyond this, there is also like content policy for doing security on your website as well. That's not something I know a whole lot. I would love to have somebody on that sort of digs deep into how that all works as well. So something to look into as well.
Okay. So let's get into the authentication process. So the registration process, as we mentioned, everything comes over the wire, plain text, is hashed, salted, stored in the database, right? For the authentication process, it's very similar. The info is still coming over plain text. And once again, it's salted and hashed. But instead of being stored in the database or anything like that, you run a compare function. So in our case, we're using bcrypt.js to generate the salt as well as hash. But there is also a function called compare, which you basically, you salt, you hash, and then you run the compare function. The compare function that takes the new password that came in and it contains the one that came in the database and it simply compares them. If they're the same, it returns a Boolean, true or false. And there's not a ton of ways to fake that. Let me tell you about that, because that hash is not something that really, especially if it's salted, it's going to be difficult to brute force that. And to be able to compare those two and say, all right, this is correct or not, that's about as secure as we can make it right now, or at least without a second factor, right? Like a 2FA or something.
Yeah. And you can also tell Bcrypt how many times you want it to do it for. So if you have a beefy server, or if you want to wait for 2 or 3 seconds, you could run this thing a couple hundred times. And that's another layer of thing, because even if somebody knows your salt and they know that you use Bcrypt and with a specific algorithm that you use, then they also have to know how many times did you run this thing? And every single time that you run it, it gets harder to reverse the entire thing. So I use Bcrypt as well on my course platform, and it works great.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's the authentication process. And then after that authentication has come back true, what we do is we create a new session in the database. We generate new access and refresh tokens. We send those along the line, and we do that via sending via cookies. Now, the one thing I didn't mention when I said that we set our cookies in the response for our server was that the cookies do take a couple of parameters besides the fact that we're sending them HTTP only and secure. One of the properties is domain, and domain can cause you a ton of trouble on Safari if things are not, let's just say, not perfect. So for us, the cookie domain needs to be essentially the root domain for us. Let's say our authentication was taking place on the server, which is api.leveluptutorials.com. The client is accessing via www.leveluptutorials.com. The origin needs to be the root domain, i.e. leveluptutorials.com. No subdomain for all of those to be accessible and work correctly. So that is the registration, authentication, and all that and more. Yowza, there's a lot of stuff here. And I feel very comfortable with our current auth system. I feel very confident with it. It allowed us to write a little bit more customization into it here and there while staying secure. I consumed just about a mammoth amount of content while researching for ours. So hit us up if there's anything that we left out or missed or could have elaborated more upon. We'll hit you up with one of those sick retweets.
All right. Other things real quick. Just if you want to make this a little easier, there's a couple of packages I like. Next Auth is something I just tried out on Friday. I needed to add Auth to a Next application, and it was so easy to get up and running. I couldn't believe it. Like maybe like 20 lines of code to get access to the GitHub login, and it worked so easy. And I was like, this is awesome, because Next does both the client side as well as it does the API routes, which is your server side. So it supplies you both the server side APIs and the hooks that you can use to log in and log people out. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. Like, very rarely have I run on platforms that do both, right?
Yeah, right.
Like Meteor was probably like that, where it does both and it's just so easy.
Yeah.
I was really impressed at how easy it was to get up and running. I personally use passport.js in my own website. It was a bear to get up and running, but that was like 5 years ago and it's been rock solid since then. Auth0 is a service. It looks like they also do like roles and permissions as well, which is pretty cool. And you can use like sign in with all these other, like you can sign in with GitHub or sign in with your Microsoft ID. So that's a service. I tend to shy away from using services for this type of thing, just because like it's not another thing I want to have to pay for and maintain. Like you said, Scott, like it probably took you a couple days to implement this yourself.
Probably took me a week researching and writing everything. And then on top of that, there's so much extra little things like sending the emails and stuff like that, that you want verification of email, those kind of aspects.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even talk about that. Password resets, things like that. Like magic links is another. We'll do another like hasty on a couple other things that we didn't talk about today, because there's some more interesting stuff we can talk about as well.
There's a lot here and we hit it all. And you know, I'm very happy and confident with the things turned out. So do you want to get into sick picks?
Yes.
I have a sick pick today, and it's my new favorite device. I got it for my birthday, which I don't know when this episode is airing. Let's see if my birthday will have passed. March 17th. Yeah, my birthday was 16 days ago by the time you're listening to this. I got this neat device. It's an e-ink tablet. I purchased it myself for my birthday because, you know, and it has a treat yourself. It has like a week-long battery life. It's called the Remarkable 2. The thing is paper thin, so it's absolutely tiny thin-wise, tablet-wise. It's about half the width of an iPad thinness-wise. And there's about zero latency on the pen. The killer feature for this thing is that it's a sketching and note-taking out or a tablet, and the latency on it is crazy good. There's a whole bunch of different pen types. There's an eraser, and it writes all in e-ink and syncs directly to the cloud. So like, for instance, I want to sketch out some notes or whatever. I just write them all up here like I would any other notebook. And next thing I know, it's on my phone. If I need to email it to somebody, do handwriting to text. This thing is expensive. I'm going to say that very clearly. It's an expensive single-purpose device, and I have not put it down. Ding dong, it is one of my favorite things in the whole world right now. And I just use it nonstop for note-taking, writing little notes, whatever, messages, planning. There's all sorts of templates, so you can get like a backdrop of a to-do list template or something like that. You can hack it. There's a huge community on GitHub of hackers for this thing. You know what the best part about this tablet, besides the fact that it feels just like paper to draw on? Like, it feels just like paper.
Yeah.
The pen, unlike the Apple Pencil, does not need to be charged, right? Doesn't need to be charged. Like, that's why I always pick up my Apple Pencil and I have an iPad and I'm like, oh, they're going to charge the pencil. Like, okay, this thing has pressure sensitivity and it's very fantastic. So check it out. Remarkable 2. I absolutely love it. And for as much as I've been shilling it, they better send me some Remarkable bucks here because I've just been posting about it nonstop. I love this thing.
I'm going to sick pick a movie, Operation Odessa. Have you seen this one? It's on Netflix.
I haven't. Oh, wait. Is it, there was like a smuggling operation?
Yes, with the subs?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I man. So, like, I love a good drug documentary or movie. And
oh, this me is, too. Cocaine Cowboys, man. It's like my number one.
Oh, there's so many. And I was like, I got to the point where I'm like, I pretty much have seen every single drug or like fraud documentary out there. And I found this new one. And it's about these like guys from Miami that are involved with like the Russian mob and the Colombian cartel. And they like would just like buy like and make speedboats for them. And they're just telling the story about how they tried to buy a Russian submarine for the cartel so they could run drugs in the submarine for like $40 million or $50 million, something insane. And the guys who are telling the stories they're the actual people who did it and are out of jail now or are on the run. And they're just such good storytellers, like the most hilarious storytellers ever. So I was very, very pleased with it. Check it out. Operation Odessa.
Yeah, it's a good one. Cool. Shameless plugs. I have a course on authentication. So if you found this to be interesting, our latest course is Node Fundamentals Authentication on levelup.tutorials.com/pro. Sign up for the year, save 25%, and you will learn how to write in Node.js the entire process from reset your password to authenticate to register. And even if you aren't planning on using this as like your authentication, I think it's still important to understand how this stuff works, especially if you want to be a quote unquote full stack developer, right? This is such a huge part about being a developer. It's important to understand how this stuff works. So Level Up Tutorials, Node Fundamentals Authentication course. And here's the best part, Wes, there is no build process for the entire course and we don't use any front-end frameworks. I'm slanging everything in vanilla JS and, you know, fetch or whatever. Ooh. just to make it as widely accessible as possible.
Beautiful. I love doing those kinds of courses because they don't go out of date immediately because it's just JavaScript.
That's my angle.
Yeah. Speaking of out of date or the opposite, my advancedreact.com course has been totally updated. Speaking of not being out of date, it's totally re-recorded with all of the latest. So it uses Keystone.js, which uses JWT tokens, Apollo 3, React hooks, function components for everything, all kinds of good stuff, headless CMS. Check it out, advancedreact.com. Use coupon code SYNTAX for $10 off.
Sick.
All right, thanks so much for tuning in. Catch you on Monday.
Peace.
Peace. We'll be right back.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.